Welcome to the quantum gravity course. So it's my first time, as you probably know, giving this class, and I decided to do some experiments with it. So it's different from the previous years. You might have, I know some of you had watched it already on Pirsa or some bits of it. So this time will be different, and we will see how it goes. So feedback is super welcome because it's a new setup and so we'll see how it works. So this is the advantage of having an elective. You have some more freedom because nobody relies on you afterwards. So what I will be doing is, I want to give, oh, and if it is too small or whatever, just let me know so you can interrupt anytime. What is the plan of the course? So I will start by revising mechanics, but from a symplectic geometry perspective. So I want to do geometrize mechanics. And the reason why I want to do this is because afterwards we look at field theory and we will use a formalism that fits quite well with this symplectic geometry. So for this, I will need to use differential forms all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, excuse me. Maybe we should check if the lecture.
Yeah, recording.
Because for Pedro, for instance, the first time it wasn't the case. So if it should be recorded, maybe we should check with the guy. Usually there is someone.
Mm-hmm. Well, if. If Craig is listening.
Waiting for the voice.
I don't know how.
Normally they just start talking because they can hear.
Craig, do you hear me?
We missed one word.
Okay, I thought it was set. If it's not, it's the first lecture, it would be, I think. So how familiar are you? So I know there was a course on geometry and topology, and which used differential forms. Did everybody follow it? Or some people were... Yeah, okay, good. So that will simplify everybody's life. Then from these, I will use it at the stepping stone to actually look at field theory. And in particular, I will discuss the covariant phase space method. So this is a method for classical field theories, which is designed to analyze symmetries of these theories. And so let's see. So the goal here is to do an in-depth study of general relativity's symmetries. And the reason why I'm choosing this tool rather than others is because, well, it's quite flexible, and GR symmetries are kind of complicated. And so this is an effective tool to study them in different layers. And also, it's a good excuse to learn about this tool, which is quite universal. And it's used a lot these days in the study of holography and also the relationship between GR and thermodynamics. So it can work also as an intro to other. Holography and especially if you heard about what people are studying a lot asymptotic infinity, especially in the null case, and a lot of these tools are used in those studies. So I think it's quite interesting in that sense to have an introduction to this stuff. And what I want to let's say the the arrival point of this, of what we will be doing, is to study essentially world paper on the neutral entropy of black, the black hole entropy as a neutral charge. So, world approach to first law of black hole mechanics. So this is the goal of section of part two. From there, so this covariant phase space, it's covariant in the sense that it is a space-time approach. It's kind of global in that sense, but it's not quite a phase space. So it's kind of an hybrid formalism between histories, where we look at field theories as like globally on space-time. But then if you want to look at boundaries, so what kind of states are involved, or for example, in holography, if you want to consider a time-like boundary and push it in into the bulk, it's not the case that we look at, but it also works for that. One has to consider boundaries in this situation. And this leads us to study the following problem. In the case, these boundaries are space-like, but in fact, things are more flexible than that. So from the covariant phase space to the canonical phase space, which is an actual, which is a true phase space now. And in particular, in the case of GR, we will look at the general relativity constraint algebra. So this is a formulation of GR diffeomorphism symmetry in the phase space language. And it's at the basis of canonical quantization of general relativity. And in particular, there is an important result that we will discuss, which is in which sense general covariance is an effective physical principle. So to build a theory. So here we will discuss how general covariance essentially completely fixes GR's dynamics and through this constraint algebra. So finally, after having done all this heavy lifting, we will look at how to quantize this constraint algebra in, well, more or less, in the in loop variables. So canonical quantum gravity. So we look at the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, Ashtekar variables, and spin networks. So I hope to have a little bit of time left, but since it's hard to plan that far ahead in for a new course, so if time allows, we will add some 3D quantum gravity where things can be done a bit more explicitly, and we can also look at the covariant picture. But it's very ambitious to get that far. So as you see, quantum gravity as such is squeezed to the end. So maybe I should apologize for that, but I think there's, yeah, I hope this will be good. Especially, it's a bit more universal in a sense, so it's a bit less approach specific, although it is a gear towards canonical quantum gravity, what I'm gonna tell. And in fact, it also serves as an introduction to other problems which are related to quantum gravity. So beside Wald's paper, here we'd also like to discuss Jacobson's paper on the space-time thermodynamics, so to say. And which will be related to both Wald's and this problem of general covariance as a physical. So we will try to look at a few classical papers on the way to make it more compelling. Are there questions at this level? Okay, so maybe, how many of you have seen symplectic geometry? Is it something familiar? Okay, not super familiar. Good. So symplectic geometry, just to say it quickly in a few words, is an expression of classical mechanics in a coordinate-free manner. So everything is geometrized. So we will use differential forms and vector fields to describe symmetries and in some cases evolution. But let me start as a motivation from the action principle. And we will see that although this is super well known to everybody, it will come back and we will use it in different forms. So I want to set up also some notation. So we have an action functional, which is given by the time integral. So here we are in mechanics, so it's a one-dimensional problem, just time. And we have a Lagrangian, and we want to take a time-independent one. So it just depends on q, and it's time derivative q dot. So what the action principle says is that the physical So if we consider the variational problem of of all possible paths that our system can take between some initial condition at time t initial to some final position at time t final, of all the possible path, the one that will be taken is the extremal one. What does it mean? It means that if we take a variation of the action, this will have to vanish at first order at the physical trajectory. So what does this mean? It means that I'm varying my path. So I go from q to delta q. So this is all evaluated at some q0 over here. So this is evaluated at q0. And I'm doing it slowly, even though I'm sure it's very well known, just to emphasize a couple of things on the way. So this delta q dot is the time derivative of delta q, because we're just thinking of varying this path. And now, since we're keeping the q's fixed at the extrema, we want to integrate this by part and put delta q into evidence, because we don't really know what to do with this q dot per se. So we get delta q minus d over dt. And now this term, this boundary term, which is extremely important for us in the following, so this is the difference of this quantity at the two extrema. We set it to 0 by hand, because we are taking delta q, q initial and q final to be fixed. So this drops. However, this will be the key guy in the second part of our study. So during the covariant phase space method, we will actually be studying this piece. So this is 0 at the extrema. And the other thing I want to emphasize is what is popping out here, which is delta L over delta Q dot, which we know to be the momentum And this is the other important piece of information that we'll use later. And of course, here we have the Euler-Lagrange equation. So these are, in general, second-order equations of motion. If we want to translate them into first-order equations, we have to go to the Hamiltonian framework. And the trick is essentially to give this piece a new name, understand it as a new variable. In the Hamiltonian formalism, we introduce canonical momentum over here, which is the same guy appearing over there, by the way, which is important. And this is no coincidence. It's because we integrated by part. It's really the same guy. And then we have to do, so I'm not going to detail this because you have already seen it many times. We have to do a Legendre transform, which means the way we have to understand this equation is as a definition of Q dot as a function of P and Q. So the way we want to understand this is Q dot as a function of P and Q. And once we have that, we can define a Hamiltonian in this way, Lagrangian Q dot, where I'm actually replacing these inside there. And now the equations of motion take a different form, which is a first order equation. So we have P dot equal minus dH over dQ, and Q dot equal dH over dQ. So I should have put this first in a sense because it's a way to rephrase this definition here. OK, so why these equations are, they're in a sense nicer than the Lagrangian ones. Why people are, well, bothered back in the days to go to this formulation? Well, being first order equations, they have a general solution that one can formally write. And the geometric reason why there is such a solution is because they can be interpreted as vector fields and their solution as flows of this vector field. So in how do I want to write this? So let's say I want to write a vector field. D over dt of U and P is equal to some vector field, which is like a velocity in phase space. Which is Q dot, so dH over dP and minus dH over dQ. So this minus signs is extremely, extremely important. So this velocity in phase space is called an Hamiltonian vector field. And the idea is that, well, it's maybe a hard thing to draw on the blackboard, but if we have Qs and Ps at every point, we have some a little vector of this. So this is dHQ and this is dQ. So given the a function h of p's and q's, I can define a vector field at every point of my phase space. And the flow of this vector field in this case is the evolution. So there are two parts to this equation. One is the definition of the vector field, and the other is the equation of motion that tell me that the velocity is exactly the time evolution is exactly given by that vector. So I want to re-express this in terms of Poisson brackets now. So these brackets are something that takes two functions on phase space. So I'm calling P this space over here. And gives me another one, and it's defined as follow. Well, I'm introducing now, in case it's a multidimensional system, I'm putting some extra indices. And here, I'm not sure about which sign is consistent with my future conventions, but it's not too important because we will not use Poisson bracket beyond today. I'm doing it. And so we see that vector field, the Hamiltonian vector field, is just H with the slot open gives me precisely that vector field. Why? Because let's see what this is. This is dH over dP dDQ minus dH over dQ I. Let's see if I put my signs all right, I think. So dDQ, so probably I want
I think it's right.
Okay.
So you'll get a Q dot dDQ and a plus P dot dDQ.
Oh, it was right before? Yeah, because this is P dot. So this is the component of that. Yeah, thank you. Okay. Q dot because it goes with Q and Q dot. Okay, so if you've ever been a little bit puzzled about where do these brackets come from, I think it's a fair question to ask. And what are these P's and Q's? Why they play this such a special role? After all, if we think in terms of these of P as the phase space as a manifold, Q's and P's are just coordinates on there. So why should they be so important? And why these canonical transformations are so important when talking about mechanics? So this is what I would like to answer next. Any questions so far? It'll be mostly unknown. Okay, so now I will change gear a little bit and give some definitions. And at the end of this series of definitions and a couple of theorems, we will go back and see how these fits with what we reviewed so far. This is the definition of a symplectic manifold. The symplectic manifold P let P be a 2n dimensional manifold. So we want it even dimensional. And let omega be a 2 form on P. Then P omega is a symplectic manifold if and only if two conditions are satisfied. And I want, so first condition is omega is non-degenerate. And second condition, omega is closed. So omega non-degenerate, there are a couple of ways to say what I mean by this, and I will go there in a second. So please remember these two conditions for, like, they're simple and they will be crucial in what follows. So just don't forget them. Non-degenerate and closed. And even dimensional, it will come out. In fact, if it wasn't even dimensional, there would be no such omega that satisfies this. So it's a necessary condition for these two to exist. OK, so what does it mean, non-degenerate? So there are two ways of seeing that. Let me give the abstract way first. So omega, I can think of it as a map, which I call omega flat, which takes a point on the tangent space. So what is this? It's a point on P and a vector at that point. So I evaluate my omega at that point, and I contract it with the vector. And what do I get? I get a cotangent vector at that point, because so this is non-degenerate if this is injective.
Could you repeat omega was a 2 form, and we are contracting with one vector.
Mm-hmm. So if you want, if you take sections, yeah, it takes a vector field into one form. It's the same. So except that written like this, it means that I'm evaluating it at each point of. So non-degenerate means that this is injective. Is the other way, and once it's injective, it's also it will also be surjective. I could say bijective. So the other way of thinking about it is to write this in coordinate, 1/2 omega ij dxi dxj. And it means that omega ij as a 2x2, sorry, as an n by n matrix is invertible. So this is, doing this operation means contracting with one of the two indices. One is left with the other one. So that's what is. So the case one would be something like times vj equal sigma I, something like this. And I want this, that the only vij that it is that goes into zero is the vanishing one, and since And then bijectivity comes from the antisymmetry. So if it is injective, bijective, because omega ij is antisymmetric by construction. Okay, so this is what.
So what you're meaning in the first one is that it's always surjective, but we just need to prove that.
No, in finite dimensions, you can just run a counting argument to say that.
That it's always surjective.
Yeah, essentially from the fact that it's an antisymmetric. So that's. It wouldn't be true for any n by n matrix, but since it's antisymmetric, the fact that it's injective is in infinite dimensions is trickier. You cannot have bijectivity here because this is a huge space. Because dualizing infinite dimensional spaces takes you to things that are way, way bigger. So injectivity is actually what one keeps in the infinite. But we will not go into this problem. Okay. Any other questions? So the next. So from these, I can give another definition that we will not really use, but it's nice to, since it's easy. It's nice to see ones. So there is a volume form in, I can wedge omega n times. And since and this will give me, since it's non-degenerate, a volume form on P. This is volume form. This is the Liouville volume form on P. So when you do thermodynamics, for example, this is your volume form on K space. So
it should be wedge product is antisymmetric, which I don't understand omega n times means. If you do 2 times omega, wedge omega is 0.
Oh, no, dx, but so here there are n core, we will see in a second what it gives, and so it will be clear that it's non zero. So dx1 wedge dx1 will be 0, but this is contains all possible combinations of these, dx1, dx2, et cetera, et cetera. So it will pick dx1, dx2 from here, dx3, dx4 from the second one, and so on and so forth. So this doesn't need to be. So it will give you the determinant, in a sense, of this matrix times d to the 2nx. Well, the Pfaffian. Okay, so, but there is an even easier way to look at this, and we'll go there now. So there is this crucial theorem, which is let Q be a manifold, T star Q, P equal T star Q is canonically symplectic. Oh, maybe I should give. Sorry, I should give another definition first to make the proofs easier. Symplectic potential. So, of course, this is an algebraic condition that I can verify point by point. This is a nastier one because, in principle, I mean, to invent an omega which is closed is more difficult than to invent one that is non-degenerate. So in a sense, I want to simplify my life and have these satisfied identically. So I can do that if I find the one form which I can differentiate to give me a two form. So this is what I call a potential. So such that, so this is the idea behind this definition. And in fact, these will be our theta in field theory. So in fact, we will always work in a case where this theta is essentially given to us to some. So you start seeing that P delta Q is theta, it will be important. Now we will see exactly why this is the case. And so this is the theorem.
What's the name of this again?
Symplectic potential. It will not, today's lots of definition and theorems to go a bit faster, but it will not be like this for a month. So the theorem is that P equal T star Q is canonically symplectic. What does it mean canonically symplectic? Is that there is always one omega, which is God-given and coordinate independent, that is given for any time I have a cotangent bundle. And the trick to prove this theorem is to realize that there is such a theta. So how does it work? The idea is essentially to go there. So let Qi be coordinates on Q on my base manifold. Then the next step is to look at TQ star at one point Q. So this is a vector space. And DQI is a basis of this vector space. And then I will call Ti the coordinates relative to this basis. On over TQ star Q. So any form alpha, any covector alpha will have, I can write it as like this. So there will be some specific values for my p's associated to my alpha that give me, that tell me what alpha is. Now, here the emphasis is on Q, but on P star Q, so these are the P's are coordinate on the cotangent spaces, the Q's are coordinate on the base, so the Q's and the P's together are coordinates on the cotangent bundle. Taken together, so once I give you Q, I fix a point on my manifold. Once I fix the P's, I give you a covector. And now theta, I define theta to be Pi dQi, and this is the called the canonical or tautological one form. It can be defined independently of a choice of coordinates as well, but so canonical. One form. And once I have this, I use it as a symplectic potential to define P theta is my canonical symplectic form. And this is the end. So which shape does it take in those coordinates? Well, it will be dP dQ. So here we start approaching that situation. And to see that, in fact, this this state of affairs is completely general. I mentioned a very important theorem by Darboux, which says that let P omega be a symplectic manifold. This is not writing over here. No, it's not that. P symplectic. Then, locally, what does it mean locally? It means there exists a chart, around every point there exists an open neighborhood such that what I'm going to say will be true. Then locally, there exist coordinates, which I'm going to call Q1, Qn, P1, Pn. Such that omega is equal to this. So in fact, even if we don't have a cotangent bundle, it turns out that locally every symplectic manifold looks like one. So let me give you an analogy. In Riemannian geometry, you can always, at each point, find coordinates such that the metric is flat at that point. So here is the same spirit, but in fact is much more powerful because this is true in an open neighborhood, not just at the point. So in this sense, symplectic geometry is much more rigid than covariant than Riemannian geometry because you can always put things in this normal form on patches, not just at points. And if you want this d omega, where is it? Disclosure is a flatness condition, so that's why it's working, because we're saying that our manifold is essentially flat in this sense, and so I can always find the neighborhoods coordinates that take this form.
I was saying even in the GR case, it is locally flat. Is it that locally condition is it's in a neighborhood?
No, that's just at first order in epsilon. At second order in epsilon, you start seeing the Riemann tensor. So if you expand your metric at second order, while this locally here is in an open neighborhood. So it's much more, it's really a chunk of the manifold. It's not just an approximation at a point. No, this is just telling you that the topology of this thing might be weird, and so you cannot always find global coordinates for that. But this is true also in the cotangent bundle case, because you might not have global coordinates on Q. So this is also true only locally. So in that sense. And these are called canonical coordinates. So now you see that the canonical coordinates of the Poisson geometries, the P's and Q's, are just locally flat coordinates in this more general framework. And so now, to conclude, I want to wrap up and show how to express those things in the symplectic language. And so we have closed the... Any questions before? Oh, I promised the Liouville form. The Liouville form. So the Liouville form in these coordinates is just what is PQ1 wedge PQn up to signs. So the reason why so in fact two forms commute with each other, do not anti-commute, so their wedge product can be known.
Yeah.
Okay. So working in this implected language is a little bit like working arbitrary coordinate in general relativity. But we're doing this in phase space. Finally, okay, what's the relation with the Poisson bracket now? So here we have a two form. There we have what is called the bivector, because it's something that derives two entries and antisymmetrizes. So the Poisson bracket that we all know and love is a bivector. And in fact, I can express it in the following coordinate free way. Where the wedge is the antisymmetrized tensor product between vectors. So it's, if I write this in those coordinates, I get exactly the canonical one. So if, so proposition, let P omega be symplectic, then pi with pi defined as the inverse of, well, maybe I should write it. This is the inverse of the omega as a matrix, point by point, is Poisson. So what does it mean to be Poisson? It means to be, it's an antisymmetric, but this is just by, because omega is antisymmetric. It's a derivation, which means it satisfies the Leibniz rule in each of its entries, but this is automatic because we are dealing with vectors, so there's not a lot to say there. And it's also, and then finally, satisfies Jacobi. So this is the most important thing. So what is a which property of omega implies Jacobi for pi?
It's non-degenerate.
So non-degenerate allows me to take the inverse.
Closed.
Antisymmetric, it's because it's a two form, so we're happy. Derivation is because we're dealing with vectors. Jacobi, there's only one left.
Closeness.
Is the closeness. So this is why closeness is, if you want, is so important. Without Jacobi, you wouldn't be able to do absolutely anything with a bracket. Well, there are. Mathematicians have looked at non-associative brackets, but it's a very complicated business. So Jacobi is extremely important here, and it's mirrored by the closeness condition. So we have seen different ways of thinking about this closeness as a flatness, which underlines this Darboux theorem, but also, and this is maybe the most intuitive way for a physicist, is to think of it as a Jacobi identity. Embedded into, and in fact, it's very instructive to look to prove these from let's say abstractly. So, what is the relationship? How do I translate beside more abstractly between omega and pi? Well, I say that if I have a function, I can find a vector field. So let's look at that equation. So this is what? This is pi ij dh dxi dxj. And this is my well, here I'm putting h, but in fact I can put any function. Let me call f. So this is the definition of XF. Now what happens if I take this to the right-hand side? Sorry, X, I, well, maybe J. So what happens if I take this to the right-hand side? So I can use my form language now. I find, so I take these here, and the equation I find is df over dxi. Well, in fact, I can remove, once I work in coordinates, I can remove these, right? Is equal to omega I j. Now, again, don't quote me on my signs. I think they are correct. But no. Without the minus? So I can write these. This is the contraction of a vector on a form. Now, it's contracting on the second in slot. So if I wanted to have contracted with the first, which is what one usually writes, one puts a minus. And so I obtain in coordinate free language, this is I xf omega equal minus df. So this, this is a crucial equation that leads me to my last definition of today. So given any f, I can find the next f. Now I'm asking for the other, like I want to give a name to these vector fields that can be obtained this way. They're not all vector fields, they're of this form. So definition, a Hamiltonian vector field. So let x, so p omega is symplectic. X is a vector field on P. Oops. X is a vector field on P. I call it Hamiltonian if and only if there exists a function called a generator. Such that the Hamiltonian generator, that equation holds. So of today, the things I want you to remember are this definition over here. That formula, that definition of Hamiltonian vector fields. And now I will say in a word why this is important, and then we will study that next time. And if you need a translation to things you had to remember, you have learned in the past, are these two things over here. So you need two conditions there. One is to invert it to get a Poisson bivector, and the other is closeness to get Jacobi. So this is a physical way of thinking of those two conditions. And of course, the Arbut theorem is really important because it tells you that there are the usual coordinates always exist. Like they're always available. So why Hamiltonian vector fields are so important? Well, because we know that if we think of f as a Hamiltonian functional, then xf is the dynamic. So it's a generalization of Hamiltonian evolution. And more generally, in fact, the best way to think of Hamiltonian vector fields is as symmetries of the system. So we will use this idea of Hamiltonian vector fields to study symmetries.
But in this definition, we didn't use Hamiltonian at all. If F was the Hamiltonian, then we could, I don't know, why are we calling them the Hamiltonian vector field?
Because someone else gave that name. So they're called like that because they generalize. So a mathematician doesn't care that an Hamiltonian defines the dynamics. They just want to know which properties is satisfied. And the property satisfies is this one. Whether X is actually the, they describe the evolution, they do not really care. And in fact, one would also, I would also add that from this perspective, the best way of thinking of X is actually as a symmetry, as a time translation symmetry, in the case of the usual Hamiltonian. And time translation, it's the symmetry that takes a solution to a solution that started a delta t afterwards. So you can think of that also as evolution. But in fact, it's probably best thought as a time translation symmetry. So that, so this is, and you can see that these vector fields satisfy a bunch of useful properties. And this is the last thing I will say today. Proposition. The lead derivative of X is an Hamiltonian vector field. Then Lx of omega is 0. How do I prove that? Do you know Cartan's formula?
Yes.
Yeah. So this is just an application of Cartan's formula, because this is Ix d omega. And so all the proof we will do, half of them will be applications of Cartan's formula.
Can
so
you find it then? Because I don't know Cartan's formula.
Is this one. So Cartan's formula says that when applied to a differential form, a lead derivative, which is defined as the infinitesimal pullback, essentially, you take the pullback along the flow and you derive it. So, but anyway, the lead derivative along a vector field of a form can be computed in this way. The contraction. So is this anti-commutator of ix and d applied? So there is a plus because they anti-commute, so that's the right sign to put, but otherwise it's like. So Cartan's formula is Lx equal this, where the signs have to be taken care of. So this is a graded. And why this is so obvious, because this is zero by definition, and this is zero because it's a d square. And for with the same formula, I can prove actually another very important fact, which is maybe not so important from an abstract perspective, but is extremely useful from when doing physics computation, which is the following. Oh, so in particular, sorry, Hamiltonian vector field, what do? They conserve the Liouville form. So this is Liouville theorem in particular. This is Liouville theorem from thermodynamics. And another simple proposition that is related to this, God, what I want. OK, I think that's fine. So here, and I will conclude, if, so let P omega symplectic and X in Hamiltonian vector field, then if I a theta, a potential exists such that Lx theta equal to 0, then x, sorry, I said something, some wrong hypothesis. I just want to say, if this is a vector field, no matter what it shapes, if it preserves one symplectic potential, so the symplectic potential is not unique. But if I can find one such that this is true, then X is Hamiltonian. And F of X is given by this contraction. And again, this is proved in one line with Cartan's formula. I will put the proof up here. All right. How does it work? I take, so this is all boring, but in physics application, every time we're given a theta, so this is the natural way to compute things. We will see that this is, in fact, appearing all the time. So here we recognize omega. And this is d of something. So we won. And we, in fact, we have an actual expression for f. So we won if this is equal to 0. So that
equal to 0 d of I. Oh, OK. That's
OK. So oops. So this is precisely this formula over here. OK, sorry for going fast. So next time we will look at actual symmetries in the sense that if we have Lie algebras acting on our phase space, which kind of vector fields come out and which properties. And so that is geared towards gauge symmetries, global and gauge symmetries in field theories in a few down the line.